Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
So it was all smiles and jokes and handshakes between Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron at the White House yesterday as the two leaders met to discuss relations between their two countries and also, of course, the war in Ukraine. But despite the friendly overtures, the divisions between the two leaders were clear. At times, they contradicted each other when facing questions from the press. Let's have a listen.
So we're at the Eiffel Tower having dinner with your wonderful wife and with my wonderful wife, and we came out and he started speaking the French deal. And we didn't have an interpreter, and he was going on and on and on, and I was just nodding, yes, yes, yes. And he really sold me out, because I got back the next day and I read the papers. I said, that's not what we said. He's a smart customer, I will tell you that.
Sure.
Europe is loaning the money to Ukraine. They get their money back.
No, in fact, to be frank, we paid. We paid 60% of the total defaults. And it was through, like the US, loans, guarantee, grants, and we provided real money, to be clear.
Again, the relationship's been very special with France and very special with this gentleman on my right. And we look forward to keeping that going for a long period of time. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
A little bit of push and pull there between the two. Well, I'm joined now by David Dunn, who's professor in international politics at the University of Birmingham, and Greg Swenson, who's chairman of Republicans Overseas UK. And you're both welcome. David, I'll start with you. What did you make of the dynamic between the two men? We heard a bit of an example of it there.
Well, it was very good-natured. It was a lot of sparring. And this is typical Trump. He doesn't actually like to contradict people face-to-face. He tends to do that afterwards or in tweets. But it was important for Macron to be in the room, to offer those correctives to the mistruths that Trump has got into his head about the proportion of money spent on Ukraine. And it was also important, actually, to stress that Europe has a meaningful contribution in this. Europe has leverage. If there are going to be troops on the ground, they're going to be European troops. If sanctions are going to be lifted, Europe has to lift its sanctions in conjunction with America. If they're going to be Russian assets unfrozen in Europe, that's a European decision. So this, what Macron was doing there was actually making the point that this cannot be a deal done over the heads of the Europeans and the Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm. It's fair to say, though, that Donald Trump really has changed the dynamic of this conflict, hasn't he? I mean, Emmanuel Macron there saying a peace deal can be achieved in a matter of weeks. We're 3 years on from the start of this, and it's only now we have movement.
Well, that's one, and certainly, that's what the Europeans are saying, that they're praising Trump for bringing momentum to it. But in actual fact, what this demonstrates is weakness. It's a weakness on the Americans that they're going back on the commitment they made to Ukraine to actually give it an opportunity to actually make progress in terms of weakening Russia and possibly getting back their territory. If peace was the only value, the Ukrainians would have given up 3 years ago and actually just rolled over to subjugation and conquest. What the Ukrainians have been fighting for and what the Americans have been backing for the last 3 years is peace with security and peace with a position whereby they're not likely to be invaded again. And unfortunately, the concessions that the Trump administration have already preemptively made in terms of no NATO membership, no American forces on the ground, no support for European forces on the ground, are all caving in. And I think what that weakness was demonstrated at the UN yesterday, when you had the Americans voting with the Russians, the Iranians, and the North Koreans, rather than with its European allies, because they don't want to offend Russia by calling it the aggressor, which of course it is. So that's a position of weakness that we're seeing being demonstrated here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're at this point now, rather than actually giving the Ukrainians the chance to fight on, which they're willing to do in order for a better settlement.
Okay, Greg, what do you make of that? Well, first of all, are you comfortable with the United States taking sides with Vladimir Putin?
Well, no, they're not taking sides with Vladimir Putin. What they're trying to do is end the war. And I think much of the support that Ukraine has received from the U.S. during the last three years has been very incremental in nature. So instead of, this sort of, it became kind of appeasement, whereas during the Trump 1.0, the Trump first term, you had deterrence, right? Trump sent Javelin missiles to Ukraine after Obama and Biden had refused to do that. We're sending blankets and MREs to an airbase in Poland and then shipping it to Kyiv on commercial trucks. You had Trump putting on sanctions on Nord Stream 2 right away. Of course, Biden relieved those sanctions and ended the sanctions when he took office in 2021. So you had a President Trump who also had conflict with Russia in Syria. You know, 300 Russian soldiers were killed at the command of the president. So I think that deterrence worked in his first term. But after the 3 years of sort of incremental and drip feed from the Biden administration, where it, you know, it was almost like the Biden strategy was stalemate, right? I mean, they didn't get F-16s till the summer of 23. They didn't, you know, they were really slow on weapons, technology, permissions. You know, remember when they stopped the Poles from sending F-16s? And even training. I mean, you know, the pilots in Ukraine had to go to Denmark to get trained on F-16s. So that incrementalist support, both from the Europeans and the Americans, just didn't work.
Okay,
and now three years later, we have a stalemate. And we just want to end the war.
But you heard what David said there, that what is on offer now is peace without security for Ukraine. And that is a really fundamental part of what Donald Trump is pursuing here, is what happens next after peace is secured.
No, David has a good point. I mean, you can't just have a peace treaty and say and walk away. I mean, obviously, Putin can't be trusted. It's got to be, you know, either trust and verify or don't trust and still verify. So I get that. But I think it has to be, there has to be much more responsibility on the shoulders of the Europeans, because the U.S., you know, really needs to pivot to the Pacific. It's important to keep Russia out of a close partnership with China. I think that's really important. And this is a way to do it, is just enter some sort of economic, you know, pact with the Russians, keep them from killing young Ukrainians and end this war. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it enables us to pivot toward the Pacific where the real dangers are, and also uplifts the Europeans to take more responsibility. Trump's been talking about that for 8 years, and it's really starting to materialize.
But I did notice that you rejected when I asked you whether you're comfortable with the United States taking sides with Vladimir Putin. You rejected that the United States is doing that. But America did vote with Russia, Belarus and North Korea on the UN resolution in New York last night.
Yeah, and I think that was a slight concession for President Trump to just stay away from using aggressive language at this moment, right? And because he wants to get something settled. If that kind of that language, you know, and by the way, like, who really cares about the UN Security Council? If they took a break from pissing Israel, which seems to be their full-time job, you know, and finally they're going to say something, you know, about Russia. Good. I mean, it's not that important at this point. I do think language matters, but more importantly, this doesn't suggest that we're siding with Russia. We're siding war. That doesn't mean we don't support Ukraine. I don't think there's any doubt that anybody has about who started this thing. But at this point, it's not a schoolyard brawl. You know, who started it pointing fingers at each other right now is not productive. What's productive is ending the war with security. And I get that.
OK, so, David, given that there's that concession there from Greg that security is needed once peace is secured, does it matter who sides with who as long as that is achieved, peace with some form of security?
Well, it matters hugely. And Greg talks about the need to pivot towards Asia. Well, what sort of signal are you sending to President Xi in his aspirations to take back Taiwan? If you won't call out the aggressor, if you already are giving away the shop in terms of the concessions you're making, in terms of no NATO membership and no American troops on the ground, and the fact that you vote with them at the United Nations, what that's showing is, rather than being this great deterrent force that Greg harks back to thinking was the case during his first administration, what you're signalling is weakness, and in terms of actually and in fact, it may well even not come to a peace, because the Russians are asking more and more of this, and what they sense is that if they hold out, they can gain more territory and more in their field, because the Americans are showing first and foremost that what they want is an end to the conflict so we can get grubby deals on oil for American companies, rather than putting any idea of principle or values or even the security of Europe as the main priority.
Greg said Joe Biden was too slow in supplying that vital weaponry to Ukraine, David, and that things might have been different now if he did. Do you think that's a fair point?
Well, the calculation that the Biden administration made was that actually if it had gone in with all those things at the very start, there was a real risk of an escalation to direct conflict between the two blocs. So what the Biden administration did was carefully boil the frog, constantly upping the level of American commitment to a point where actually the Russians are now having unsustainable losses in terms of both their armor and in terms of their artillery and in terms of their personnel, and their economy is really squeezed. And many analysts say that if they kept this on for another year, the Russians will be forced to actually seek terms on the West's terms rather than giving them in what they're doing by the Trump administration now. So America is giving the wrong signals now at the wrong time, making massive concessions to the Russians so that they are seen to win. They're already going to get at least 20% of the territory, and they're also demanding that the regime in Kyiv goes through elections, so it creates a bit division, so it has a change of regime. What they want is a supplicant in Kyiv, and that's what they're demanding. And the Trump administration does not seem to be in any way given the signals that it's prepared to stand up to them.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, you've been very reasonable on the need for security after peace. I mean, is there any part of you concerned that Donald Trump is being led by the nose here by Vladimir Putin?
No, not at all. That's obscene. And you can see that the president is actually going back to the Democrat playbook of the past. You know, I mean, you could go back to Henry Wallace during the Truman administration, but more recently, you know, it's very similar to both the Germans with Gerhard Schroeder and Angela Merkel, that, you know, we're working, you know, doing business with the Russians. Maybe that was perhaps to avoid conflict, but, you know, they thought economic activity was a good thing. Now, it ended up being too much dependence on Russian oil and natural gas, of course. But then if you look at Obama, who considered antagonism with Russia to be a Cold War, you know, vestige, and even made fun of Mitt Romney about that in 2012. And then, of course, Biden, who just sort of parked it and wanted to avoid conflict, which is a noble thing. But that ended up being appeasement, right? I mean, he took the sanctions off Nord Stream 2, as I mentioned. He took, you know, other adversaries off the terrorist list. I mean, that kind of didn't work. But if anything, Trump is going back to that, you know, the Democrat playbook of, you know, not necessarily appeasement, but just saying, let's do some business and stop killing each other. I think that's a pretty noble goal. I do think it will come with security. The president will back the Europeans, not necessarily with troops on the ground. That's not the role for the U.S. in this case. But if the, you know, it's almost like switching roles with Germany. Germany has to take a more of a leadership role in defense and security and back away from the economic dependency. And if the U.S. can create some kind of economic upsides for both countries, to rather than trying to escalate in terms of defense, all the better. And I think the focus on the Pacific is important right now.
But David says that if, you know, the West had continued to boil the frog in the way that Joe Biden and his administration were for another year, Russia would have been in a position where it couldn't have continued on with the war.
Possibly, but you could say the same about Ukraine. You know, I mean, it's, and I think, you know, there is some merit to the argument that if we had been a little bit more supportive at the beginning.
Oh, we seem to be just losing.
Ukraine dying in F-16s. It's because they weren't trained and they didn't have the Link 16s, which are really important for communicating. So they're getting.
Okay, Greg, your line is just dropping on us there. David, I might come back to you about Keir Starmer, who's visiting Donald Trump on Thursday. I mean, what do you make of his promise now to send peacekeeping troops to Ukraine? And do you feel nervous about Keir Starmer's visit, given what we saw with the dynamic between Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron last night in the Oval Office?
I think everyone is right to be nervous about at this point in time, because the Americans have abandoned a policy of supporting European security and any idea of a principled, robust response to territorial acquisition through the use of force and brutality and war crimes in the abduction of children. What we have instead is a president who is not willing to support Ukraine in its battle, not even willing to call out the fact that Ukraine has been the victim of aggression by Russia. The fact that he won't even say that is an indication of where they're coming from. And of course, another aspect of the American approach is to try and use the vulnerability of Ukraine to extort from them its mineral wealth in perpetuity. It's almost like the carve-up of Poland by Russia and the Soviet Union and Germany in 1941. So Starmer's job is a very difficult one next week. He will try and be as diplomatic as possible. He will try to not criticize Trump, because Trump is a very thin-skinned egotist who doesn't like being criticized even when he's wrong, and therefore it's a delicate job to do on Starmer's part. But again, what he's doing is interjecting the Europeans into the situation when they've been previously cut out at the talks in Saudi Arabia, to say actually that all of European security is in play here. This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the security of Europe. And Americans need to think carefully about how they proceed here, because there's a danger of sending signals to Russia that make Europe insecure in the future, and sending signals globally that make the world insecure by American weakness.
David, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's Professor David Dunn. And earlier we heard from the chairman of Republicans Overseas UK, Greg Swenson. Now, coming up after the break, that Dáil speaking row, it's back on the agenda.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.